at Irregular Hours, episode 130 for September 22nd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidar.
And we are here with our great book club. Today we are continuing our discussion of From Hell by Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell. And today we are joined by the illustrator, Eddie Campbell.
Isn't that incredible?
Yes.
I'm actually super excited because I've talked to some authors before, but never to an illustrator.
Today, we were going to discuss chapters 9 through 12, but we are joined by Eddie Campbell. Eddie Campbell, you know, of course, is the illustrator of this work, and let's see what kind of interesting tidbits we can gain from our discussion.
This is the From Hell Companion, which I published in 2014. In which I explain From Hell, or I told From Hell from another angle, using Alan Moore's scripts and Alan Moore's sketches and different bits and pieces that we produced along the way. For instance, Alan Moore wrote a huge document when it was going to be made into a film, because we're only halfway through it at that point. They bought the film rights to the book. They were going to make the film of a book that wasn't finished yet. Alan Moore wrote this document explaining how the book was supposed to finish. And there's loads of things. This was like several thousand words. There's loads of things in it that didn't end up being in the book. Or they ended up being alternative versions of the way the book played out. And so I used that, for instance, I quoted passage from that where they were relevant, because the From Hell Companion follows the narrative scheme of the original From Hell, but it uses different materials to tell the story and comes up with different results in places.
Oh, interesting.
Really?
So that's Alan Moore's scripts, my essays. It's all prose with illustrations, but it tells the story from a different angle. That was the last time I knew what was going on in From Hell.
Okay. Is that different than, all right, so when the colorized version was released as a monthly series, at the end, we have the appendix, but we also had some additional notes at the ending of that.
And those were Alan Moore's scripts, yeah.
Okay.
Alan Moore, because I noticed in one of your notes for this, you were talking about how there are long silence passages in from chapter 10.
Yes. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that Alan wrote less.
Uh-huh.
He still wrote the same amount. In his descriptions, he would describe a panel. He would draw a little thumbnail of it, and then he would describe what he was seeing. And sometimes it'd be 1,000 words. Sometimes it'd be 1,300 words to describe a little picture.
Really? And then it was up to you to translate that thought into an illustration.
Into a simple picture 2 inches wide. Shall I read you a bit?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. We would love to hear it.
This is a bit. Alan wanted, an alligator in the gutter. He wanted to show the variety and complexity of Victorian London, and he wanted an alligator crawling in the gutter. And this was in chapter 3. I said, Alan, the way we've set this up, to be a kind of humdrum police procedural, if I start putting alligators in the gut without there being a full explanation as to what the alligator is doing there, we're going to lose control of the style of the whole thing. It's going to become Salvador Dali or something. So I said, well, okay, not to worry, Eddie, as long as you get the rest in. So this is chapter 3, where Marie is walking from the Ringer's pub. No, she's walking to the Ringer's pub, where she's had a client up against the fence.
Yes, I remember this.
Remember this scene?
Yes.
Marie now continues down Commercial Street towards Spitalfields Market, down at the end of Brushfield Street, nearest to Christchurch. The church itself probably isn't visible here. In the foreground, we see the bizarre, dirty, sprawling pocket world that is the marketplace. Everything conceivable is for sale or display. In the foreground, a man leads a skinny albino male through the street, a rope about the poor creature's neck. The albino's hair is long and straggly, his pale brows turned upwards in abject misery. as he's led through the filthy and clamorous streets. Somewhere nearby, a boy holds up a fistful of yellowing haddock, calling out to the passing crowds. Elsewhere, a fat woman with a strawberry mark parades her tray of whelks. From the background, Marie walks nonchalantly towards this press of bodies and vitality, thinking more about the cold sperm trickling down her legs than the various wares upon display. Panel two.
That's correct.
Etc.
So that's quite a challenge, sir.
But tell us about the alligators. So
that's panel one. I refuse to do those alligators. And so the next couple of panels had the same thing, you know. Across the street from Marie, there's a couple of children aged about nine having sexual coitus. And the children take no notice of Marie whatsoever. And I said, Alan, I can't get any of this in. I'm just going to have a walking pass. We'll have a busy mess in the background suggesting the clamor and noise of Victorian London. And I think this rankled with Alan because in chapter six, there's a sequence there where it's just Abilene. You probably remember Abilene.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten the name of the other. They're talking. He says, bloody hell, says, I've forgotten the other guy's name. Hell's about right. I've seen it all here, lad. Alligators waddling through the shit in the gutters. Albinos being led about in chains. All the things I didn't draw. Aberline saying he saw them. I saw them. He says, I've stepped over kids no more than nine, having it off in broad daylight, probably with their sisters. Well, they're married by 12, most of them, says the other cop, whose name I've forgotten. That's right. And when they separate, she'll start whoring. 1,200 tarts in Whitechapel officially. My arse. Anybody in Whitechapel is yours for under a shilling. I mean, how are you supposed to manage it, eh? Et cetera, et cetera. He goes on grumbling because he's a curmudgeon. So this was the friction between the writer and the artist. If I couldn't get it in the picture, he was going to get it in there somehow.
What is fascinating is Moore's writing talks about all these colors, and it's a black and white presentation at that time.
Yeah. He described what he was seeing, but he did a little sketch, and then he described what was in the sketch. That what I read there was very unusual. He must have been on something that day. He must have been smoking something. Because usually he described the picture, whereas there he described a movie. You know, there was a movie going on that would be impossible to put into one picture.
To one 2-inch square.
Yeah, it was two inches wide by 3 inches tall, I think, is the public size of a picture. He decided at the beginning that because he'd already done Watchmen on this 9-panel grid, and he was fascinated with this 9-panel grid idea, not to distract from the simple goings on by having wild, odd-sized pictures. Every picture's the same size. It's measured out in a rhythmic 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, begin again. It's a march toward an inevitable conclusion. There's no variety in the display.
You snuck a couple of double-sized panels in there.
Every now and then he will link up panels horizontally or once or twice even vertically. But not often.
Have you looked at this book through an e-reader, like Comixology? The 9-panel grid becomes a 1-panel or 2-panel review, and it changes maybe a little bit of how a person experiences the story.
Are you aware of when a page finishes reading it like that?
No.
No. Well, you're aware when the chapter ends because it goes to the quotes.
I would think you'd be losing something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never surprised nowadays. I did a hugely intricate little book with Neil Gaiman titled The Truth is a Cave, The Black Mountain. It's wall-to-wall color, and they'd started to design the ebook version, and they sent me a few pages, and I was so disappointed. I thought, I don't want to get involved here. I've no idea why anybody would want to read this as an ebook. it just didn't make sense. But then I don't know, because so many readers now, I'm not even sure they're looking at the pictures.
We've discussed that. The difference between our reading styles is certainly on display when we're reading this graphic novel versus prose. And Pam is the type of person who really looks at your illustrations and really takes time on them.
I actually find I read slow. Like, I read a graphic novel much more slowly than I would read a textual novel. I just really get caught up in the pictures. And sometimes I have to go back and read the text because I'm just following the pictures.
I remember I was asked on a TV show, they cut this bit out, thank God, because I went off on a rant. The interviewer was saying, this was 20 years ago, he said, how are you supposed to read a graphic novel? And you know, do I read the words first and then the pictures, or do I look at the pictures? And I said, that's amazing that you would be so well brought up, you don't know how to read a comic. Then I developed that into a mad rant. So well brought up, but they can read magazines, or you know, all the complicated typography of magazines nowadays. They have no trouble with that. But they're so snobby, they don't know how to read a comic.
It's a different experience, for sure.
Something else I've noticed in recent time. When I bought a comic book, I was kind of interested in what the Fantastic Four were doing or what Thor was doing. But I was much more interested in what Jack Kirby was doing. I was much more interested in the relationship between Stan Lee and Jack Kirby than I was in the relationship between Spider-Man and Mary Jane or whatever. Audrey, I'm married to Audrey Niffenegger, as you probably know.
Yes, we are aware. We've sent her an email to do an interview for the Time Traveler's Wife as well. So if she's around...
Audrey gets irritated when she sees the same actor from somewhere else, because that disturbs the reality of the, of the drama that she's watching. In her ideal world, the actor would be so disguised that you wouldn't know the actor. You would really think it was this person, this character that you were looking at. But I'm probably more interested in the actor than I am in, and everywhere there. Sometimes I'll stop the film, which irritates the blazes out of it. I say, let's stop it a minute. Actually, we're watching one last night. We're watching the all these series. We're watching Newsroom. And I said, okay, I know her. She played Harvey Pekar's wife in American Splendor. Hope Davis, it was. But I had to stop. Stop the thing, go to IMDb, find out the name of the actor. I said, oh yeah, there she is, it's the same actor. Audrey gets so irritated when I do that. Stop the thing, go and look up IMDb and find out the previous appearances of the actor, because that's of more interest to me than the characters sometimes.
Or, well, the British, there are only 18 actors in Britain.
Yeah,
so
that's right. And Dame, what's name, is three of them.
And David Tennant is at least two.
Yeah.
But Eddie, I love that you do this sort of metafictional rant, right, about this connection between reality and representation, because that's what From Hell is all about, really. It's really, it really connects to this idea.
My favorite part of From Hell is I presume you've all got to the end of it by now, yeah?
We are only on chapter 12 this week, so we're going to get to the end of it next week, so no spoilers.
But the appendix, the 24-page appendix in Comic One, we debunk all of the Ripper theories, including our own.
Right. I skipped ahead and looked at that. It was awesome.
And we actually appear, Alan and I actually appear in it briefly.
In the comic, in the illustrations, or in the index?
In the appendix, too.
We're in the illustrations.
Really?
Yeah. It's a brief history of Ripperology, in which we look at all of the theories, debunk them, laugh at them, mock them, including our own. It's the best chapter in the book.
I've absolutely, in fact, when I read this 20 years ago or so, I had not read the annotations. And it was a person who I read a review, and they said, read the annotations. You're going to get so much more out of the book.
Yeah.
This has been, it's been wonderful to read those. Tell us a little bit about updating the story from its original black and white presentation to this new color presentation?
We haven't changed it. We haven't added anything. Alan originally wanted to add another appendix because there's the first appendix, which is the notes, and then the second appendix, which is an entire 24-page comic, which is what I was referring to a minute ago. He wanted to do another appendix where he would bring things up to date on Ripperology, because in the 20 years since we finished, a great deal has happened. Just in the last 10 years, there was Patricia Cornwell's book where she went to great lengths to make Walter Sickert the murderer. I think she'd bought one of his paintings and obtained DNA evidence from it. I don't know how you obtain DNA evidence from a painting. I've got one of those boxes over there in the bathroom. You know those cologne? You have to send me another one. You're supposed to shit in the box and send it off in the mail. It took me months to do this. But the whole pro, you'll know this when you get to a certain age. You'll get your box in the mail. Your doctor will say, it's about time. Your box in the mail.
You know your career's not going well when you have to shit in a box.
Yeah. And then get it. Get the box and pour them the chemicals. Get the little chemicals and pour it in. But seal it all up. And then run around and find a UPS. And it says in the box what it is. The guy in the UPS knows what it is. Anyway, I got a phone call a week later, and they said, Mr. Campbell, your test failed. We couldn't get any DNA from it. Would you like us to send another box? They sent another box. This was a year and a half ago. I still got the other box here. They couldn't get any DNA off my shit. How are they going to get off Walter Sickert's painting?
Oh, modern times.
I quoted one of Alan's anecdotes in here. He said, I'm sick of them sending me these books. Every time there's an update on Jack the Ripper, they send me a book. They send me the book. And the latest one is all about what have we applied modern methods? What if Jack the Ripper was running around doing it now and they applied modern methods to solving the case? So there's a whole chapter about DNA. The whole book, I think, is about what they got is DNA from the murder scenes. And Alan said they'd have caught him on the CCTV cameras that have gone around his house, arrested him, and that would have been the end of the whole thing. No need for the DNA. Now, there was an opera last year called The Women of Whitechapel in London. Do you remember that?
No.
It was, a great melodramatic opera. But it was the story of the women. And there was a book also last year just called The Five. It was the five victims who told a non-fiction book, told their stories seriously, made the case that these women weren't prostitutes. They were just down on their luck. But see, I used to have an aunt who died 20 years ago, but she thought that any girl who had sex outside of marriage was a prostitute. It's prostitution. And I think this was the case even in Victorian times, that anybody who was a bit who wasn't strictly legit in the sexual department was a prostitute. And so this is why we get thousands and thousands of prostitutes accounted for in London, is that anybody who was sleeping with their boyfriend was counted under that heading.
Pam is the professor who teaches all about Victorian times at the University of Connecticut. So, Pam, is that something that you've studied?
Sure. There's virgins, whores, and mothers. Those are your three options. Exactly what Eddie says. So, if you don't follow, monogamous mores,
there's no room for variation.
Mandated by marriage, then yes, you're a prostitute or a whore.
And so we have this unbelievable, implausible number of prostitutes walking about in Victorian London.
A number, just an incredible number. That's interesting. I mentioned a little bit about the update in coloring.
I didn't want to come to the book and say, oh, it's terrible. I drew this 20 years ago. I can draw it better now. I'm just reminded, I bought this little fanzine once, a little fanzine comic, and he'd include a little piece of paper in erratum, you know? He didn't, you know, if you have a misprint, it's too late to fix it. It's yes. printed. You can put a little slip in the book, a little erratum or errata, if you've made more than one mistake. And it said erratum. The drawings in this book should have been better.
I love the style that you chose, Eddie. Can you tell us about your choice of the art style here?
I didn't want to draw in a deliberately Victorian style because I think ordinary illustration in Victorian times is just terrible. I don't want to look like that. But I wanted to give myself the tools that a Victorian would have and the frame of mind. Up until 1890, illustration in books had to be reproduced through woodcuts, wood engraving. And in order to do that, the artist either did a drawing which was copied by the engraver onto the woodblock, or he, if he was well connected with the publisher, like the Punch artist, where he would get a block to draw on. So he would do his drawing on the block, which then went to the engraver who carved that pencil drawing into the wood. So that means that my drawing is being reinterpreted by an engraver. And what happens around 1890 is that ink drawings can now be photographed. So it's my drawing that is published and not my drawing as reinterpreted by another hand. And what happens in art in the 1890s is that the artist is suddenly liberated. And he expresses his liberation by throwing the ink lines around with panache and dashing and dare. And you get a lot of very daring and exciting ink work in the 1890s because the artist, he's now free to do it. What you're seeing is now the work of my hand where it didn't used to be. So I'm going to enjoy exercising my hand. I'm going to throw these lines around in a devil may care way, because the problem with the woodcut was it was always kind of heavy-handed by necessity. In order to carve those huge blocks, sometimes for a full page, for instance, in order to carve a full page block and have it in time for a weekly magazine, the engraver used to have a shop of sub-engravers. And the block would be cut into parts, and each one of his team would get a part to work on. Then when they were finished, the parts of the block would be bolted back together, and the master engraver would put a few continuous lines across the whole thing to establish continuity or fix one or two problems that he saw, to unify the thing. But because of this working method, there's always a dullness of surface in wood, and except from the very highest and best, like Dalziel or Swain. I'm talking London. I can't remember who the main ones were in New York.
Okay.
But for instance, the Dalziel who did Alice in Wonderland was a wonderful, they're wood engravings, but beautifully made by a master craftsman. But most of the time, that's not what was happening. Most of the time, you get a really dull surface. And so to get back to the point, I wanted to put myself in the frame of mind of that artist who has just been liberated. It's my pen lines, you're saying, the work of my hand, the dash, the sweeping line, the scribble, the splash of ink with the brush or whatever. I want to get something of that quality in there. So if you look at the dead seagull in the very first panel of the book, you can see me getting into that frame of mind, because this is not how I usually draw. From Hell style is not necessarily Eddie Campbell style. Every one of my books looks different.
And then in chapter 5, you've used a totally different style to show us what life was like for Gull versus the prostitutes.
That again, because another thing that could be done with now that the art was being photographed, because halftones come in at the same time. Mm-hmm. In fact, they could halftone art just before they could halftone photographs. So that you can photograph an ink wash and reproduce it in half tone.
So is that what that is? An ink wash, not exactly a watercolor?
Yeah.
Okay. Very similar though, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I know things about art, Chip.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. So when we moved it to color, that changed a little bit about how the ink gets.
You've seen the color?
Yes, sir.
People have got the book, and I haven't got a copy yet. I haven't seen a copy.
Well, it was released just a few days ago.
Yeah, so I've seen them talking about it on Twitter, and I thought, when did I get my copy? Something's wrong with it. I'm going to be too late to just. I'll be too late to go down there and demand. I'll go down to the printer and demand that they destroy the entire print run. There's a famous anecdote. Well, it's not that famous. There's an anecdote about Bill Mauldin, the famous cartoonist. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his depictions of the two GI infantry, Willie and Joe,
yes.
During the war. The two ordinary grunts, GIs. And the cartoons are hilarious. They're one of America's cartoon masterpieces, collected in book form. They were first collected in a book. It was his recollections of the war, illustrated with his own cartoons. It was called Up Front, and he published it just after the war, just a few weeks after the end of the war, a few months. And he dedicated it to his wife. And somewhere between the book going to the printer and coming back from the printer, it hasn't come back from the printer yet, he's discovered that his wife was untrue to him while he was away, while he was in Italy, drawing for Stars and Stripes and so on. He's only just discovered after the books, with the book at the printer. He got terribly drunk one last night, and he got into his Jeep because the army let him keep his Jeep. And he drove down Fifth Avenue, and he tried to drive through the revolving doors of the hotels he was staying at. I can't remember. But anyway, he was so upset upon discovering that he then got out of his Jeep and stormed off down to the publisher in the middle of the night, banging at the door to get in and demanding that every dedication page in all 20,000 copies be razored out of the razored out of the book.
All right, so let me ask you a little bit about the architecture and the mapping that was put together to kind of put together this conspiracy.
We love conspiracy theories as a race because we can't live with the thought that the universe is in disorder and has no meaning. We would rather believe that evil people are in charge than that nobody is in charge, which is what conspiracy theories are usually about. They're usually about wicked people at the top manipulating the world. We would rather believe that than believe it's all chaos. I think we have religion for the same reason. We're too afraid to stare into the void and think nobody's in charge.
That's...
I quite like the lockdown because I'm afraid to go out of the house now. The universe is too frightening. I'm starting to wish I believed in conspiracy theories. Wish I believed in something I could...
Certainly they're attempting to put order...
If I get run over by a car, it'd be an accident. It wouldn't be an accident because somebody hated me. So I had to be brought down for some reason. I'd spoken out against the Masons.
Sure. In fact, I was going to a little bit ask about that.
I'm going to come to that eventually.
The Mason rituals that were being presented here. Have you ever had anyone who is a Mason address it?
I've had one of the Masons write to me with jocularity and say that they were quite amused by it. But nobody's been upset.
Not that they've run you over with a car with yet.
In that appendix, the comic appendix at the end, and after he was down visiting Christchurch, Alan believes he was followed home by a mysterious truck. But I don't believe I'd be very surprised if I've got any of that stuff right. I try to make it a little bit more right in the color version, since I've learned in the meantime this or that. But and see, the thing with the color version, as I was saying a while back there, we started this thing 30 years ago and finished it 20 years ago. And I was working on it when I was living in Australia, and we didn't have the internet to research things. If I couldn't find it at the library, I had a pretty good library nearby, but often I couldn't put my finger on the thing I needed. A lot of the time I just had to depend on Alan's descriptions of things, or there was a whole building that I couldn't find, which I've now found, like Bedlam, the madhouse. Mm-hmm. Couldn't find a photo of it. And so I've found a photo now, and I've replaced it. I've replaced the whole panel. So it's not just coloring. There's a lot of fixing of mistakes. The carriage that Netley's driving in, I've given him a limousine of a carriage. It should have been a much more ordinary carriage. And so I've fixed that all the way through. You see, at the beginning, I thought, who is Netley? Does he work at the palace? Is he a coachman for that? It's never clear. We never really, where does he keep his horse?
You needed more detail in each panel. That's what you're trying to say.
We should explain about Netley's horse. They're kind of negligent. It's just, he goes and gets the horse. I said, well, how does it work? Just park it like you park a car. George Carlin said, you know, when he was a kid and he was watching the cowboy movies, he said whenever a cowboy got killed, he always wondered who got to keep his horse.
The devil is in the details.
Usually the horse runs away and nobody cares about the horse. Like, I was illustrating a thing called the Black Diamond Detective Agency, which takes place in the 1890s, and the hero rides his horse to Chicago. The hero is wanted by the Secret Service at this point, and he rides the horse to Chicago, and he's gonna go into Chicago by foot. But in the script, he slaps the horse, which I didn't write. He slaps the horse on the rump, but it's still got its reins and saddle, and the horse runs away off into the wild. And I thought, well, the guy's got no money. So I invented this whole scene where he's at a horse trader. You see him coming out of a horse trader counting his money, which wasn't in the script. I'll fix it. I won't say who wrote it, but I thought, I'll fix this now. It's funny, it took place in Chicago, and I'm now living in Chicago.
Yeah.
This book was done in 2006.
Are you familiar with the story or who H.H. Holmes is?
No.
Hold on.
See the guy, wait a minute, he was the guy at the fair.
That's right.
Exactly.
Columbian Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Who subsequently...
Sort of the American version of Jack the Ripper.
Committed some murders and... Yeah. Yeah, right, in 1893.
Yeah,
that's right.
Around that same time.
And right there in Chicago. Mm-hmm.
For a person who has never read this book and is going to experience it for the first time, what do you want them to take from this reading?
It's a journey into the mind of a serial murderer. I don't mean a typical serial murderer. I mean this serial murderer. When they made the movie out of it, it was Touchstone. It ended up with Touchstone. It didn't start there, but it ended up Touchstone. And Touchstone only wanted to do it if it was a whodunit, which meant they had to go through the whole rigmarole of lining up the suspects and all the things you have to do, all the whole formula of the whodunit, which totally ruined an opportunity. If they'd just done it like the book, they could have had Hannibal Lecter before Hannibal Lecter. We know he's the murderer from the beginning. There's no secret about it. It's not whodunit. We know who the villain is. And this is the story of what he did and how it came about and how it happened and how it came to be that he was never found out.
And in addition to that, his line of thinking. We've gotten to, in chapter 10 here, we've got the fantasy of he's in the middle of this terrible murder and he's transported through time and he sees modern computers and things and is flummoxed by that.
And his critique of the modern world is so wonderful, but it's coming from the mouth of a madman. I thought that was quite marvelous, Alan.
Is it coming from the mouth of a madman, or is it coming from Alan?
Yeah.
Or is that both the same thing?
I've got to be careful here. It is beautifully. It's a beautiful, wicked observation of the modern world in which we find ourselves agreeing with the madman. Mm-hmm. Another thing about the whole book was that we were never invested in whether it was Gull that did it. We don't care who did it. In fact, Alan has said that. I've said it. I don't think Gull did it. I think Gull is a really interesting personality, a really interesting figure. For instance, something we don't mention in the book, but it was William Gull who wrote the paper and gave the name to anorexia nervosa.
Really?
Interesting.
We do show that he there's a ward where he's studying mad women.
Mm-hmm.
He had particular interest in women. But the idea that he was Jack the Ripper, I think Alan came to this story before he'd really worked everything out. And he was interested in it as a story. And whether or not a story is true, a story still has a presence in the world. The example that, get an itchy nose, the example he used to give was that, remember they decided that we had dinosaurs' legs on back to front?
Yes, and the idea that Monty Python then Terry Gilliam drew all sorts of fun with that idea. Yes,
yeah. But they should be we've been putting the skeletons together wrong. The legs should be round the other way, like birds' legs.
Yes.
So having put them round the wrong way, we had these upright Tyrannosaurus rex who dragged its tail around, and we now have it bird-like with its tail in the air. Mm-hmm. But even though we've corrected that, there's still like a 150 years of wrong ones. In fact, where I used to live, there was a wrong one outside the National History Museum. This upright dinosaur dragging its tail. So the story still has a place in the world. This was out in the garden, out standing there visible from the road, this incorrect dinosaur, which they maybe it's probably still there. But a fiction makes a place for itself in the world, and you can't just change it by saying, oh no, we got that wrong. The fiction still exists. The story, like, we've replaced Greek mythology with Christianity, but Greek mythology still exists. Yeah. It's wonderful. It's glorious, and it's a beautiful thing. There's no way we want to get. You can't suddenly obliterate. You can't get rid of all those statues or all the poetry and metaphor, and so on. It's made its place in the world.
Where can our listeners find out more about the projects you're working on, and more about From Hell?
I've got a website, EddieCampbellDammit.com. I didn't want to be Eddie Campbell 721. Audrey said, why don't you just be Eddie Campbell, damn it. That's a good idea. So it's Eddie Campbell, damn it. DAMMIT. Eddie Campbell, damn it, .com.
That was Audrey's idea?
Yeah.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I can only imagine.
Audrey and I did a little book 2 years ago called Bizarre Romance. I don't know if you saw that. I don't have a handy one here.
I will absolutely look into that, because I love her work as much as I love yours, and I can only imagine the creativity that goes on in your home.
Bizarre Romance was, it's basically me illustrating Audrey's short stories. It's there's 13 of Audrey's short stories, half of which I've turned into comics.
Okay.
Others I've furnished with large illustrations. So it's, because I thought there must be people there, again, they're going to pick this up, expecting Audrey's prose. They'll be terribly disappointed if we don't give them some of Audrey's prose here.
Wonderful.
So it's a little packed, tight book of imagination. And on the front, there's a... I wish I had one handy. On the front, there's a bear hugging a bird. Bizarre Romance.
That sounds lovely. That sounds lovely. So I know that you also can purchase your books at your local bookstore. Or there's plenty of online retailers also that have
top shelf, your books. Topshelfproductions.com has most of my books.
Okay.
Top Shelf Productions.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us, Eddie. This has been, we've just been fascinated just sitting at your feet and listening to your stories.
And we've been truly enjoying going through this story. Pam and Steve are reading it for the first time.
Right.
Excellent. Well, I haven't given anything away.
Thank you for that.
Yes, and really, really appreciate your insights, and love to think about illustration in the 1890s. It's just given me a ton to think about, so thank you.
So there's going to be a paper in this for Pam, right?
Jack the Ripper gets away with it. He's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
And always will be.
That's right. Wonderful. Thank you, Eddie Campbell, the illustrator of From Hell. We really have been enjoying this book, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
So guys, I just thought that was incredible having Eddie here today. That was so much fun. And I'm sure that we all had different things that really struck us, but I was fascinated by the idea that 1890s illustrators are being photographed for the first time. And, you know, I have like this secret love of romantic poetry, which is totally outside of my area of expertise, but I love William Blake, who illustrated his poems almost 100 years earlier than this. And when Eddie said that there's this sort of liberation in the 1890s, and he was trying to capture that, I just thought that was really an amazing insight into this. And it was funny because I sort of wanted to ask him, and then the moment passed by, about that question that I was curious about, which is how he represents sexuality in this graphic representation of sexuality that's somehow not overly erotic, but that's very graphic. And I felt like that answered my question. That notion of the artist that is liberated to speak directly to the public and not be mediated through the engraver. And so I felt like what he was talking about really captured why the 1890s are such a fascinating moment, stuck between the Victorian and the modern period, and also why we continue to think about Jack the Ripper. When he suggested, which I think Moore suggests in the text as well, that we believe in evil people because we hate the idea that the world is a chaotic space where no one is in charge. You know, the 1890s are also when people start to really, really seriously, in large numbers, think about the death of God. So it was just so great to get his insights that are really dovetailing with a lot of the topics that we've been talking about for the last 150 days as we've been thinking about this amazing period that still has so many resonances for us in 2020.
I think I smell another paper from Professor Bedore on illustrations and how those illustrations came to be. I don't know that you've explored that before this.
No, never. And the idea of mediation, right? And the idea of how genres mediate, that's something that I think about all the time. And again, because that was an incredible interview, I don't know how deep we want to go into each of the chapters today or how much we might hold some of that till our next episode, because we still have some time with this book. But like, what genre is this book? It's a graphic novel. Is it a detective novel? Is it true crime? Is it speculative fiction? Right? And I mean, Eddie brought that up a little bit too, saying some people could try to tell this story in a whodunit way, but that is not what he and Moore were doing here.
It's such an interesting study in psychology, too. Mm-hmm.
Why I just looked at Nietzsche, because I wanted to say, okay, I knew Life that.
God.
Yeah, and that certainly of that time, that was when he was writing, or a little bit earlier than that. But
yeah, but in large numbers, Chip, it's this exact moment that people are starting to be like, do I believe in God? Wait, I should believe, do I?
Certainly.
Wow. This is the right book. I'm glad that Chip brought this book to us in the book club, because we are...
Yay, Steve! Steve comes around. This is totally the right book.
This is the right book. I didn't say that I love this book. I said this is the right book because it fills into exactly the conversation that we've been having for the last 150 days. Yeah. And having the insight from the illustrator has certainly brought something special to the book club this week.
Absolutely. And this is so dark compared to Sherlock Holmes, but it's that looking backward perspective on this period that Doyle presents to us with just a ton of humor and connecting humor and pathos. But this is the exact same moment seen from this very conspiratorial perspective. You guys, I never look at the end of books. I don't know what possessed me, but last night I started looking at Appendix 2, which is horrible. I never do that. But Appendix 2 is amazing. And it's in our homework for the group for next week. But I cannot wait to talk to you guys about it. It's incredible. You guys know how much I love metafiction. When people actually look at how fiction works explicitly within their fiction, this Appendix 2 is awesome.
Something that we should once again mention is that this was written in the, was it 1990?
Yeah, so 1989 through 99.
So we're basically looking at 100 years since the Doyle stories began, the Sherlock Holmes stories began. So, I mean, certainly where the writer and the artist are at a different point in history, they're looking back where Doyle was writing contemporary, or 10, 15 years.
And how interesting for Alan Moore to put that metafiction into Chapter 9, where he has the character say, mark my words, in 100 years there'll be some people, I'm editing myself and Alan Moore, there'll be some people like him wrapping these killings up in supernatural twaddle, making a living out of murder. That is some interesting metafiction, because Alan Moore is making money out of this murder 100 years later.
But more important, he's making art out of it.
Mm-hmm. And with the illustrations from Eddie Campbell, amazing. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Pam, what's our assignment for next week?
Okay, we have to come back next week. And next week, we are reading chapters 12 through 14, as well as the two appendices. Now, the first appendix, we've kind of been reading all along because it gives us notes to the chapters. But the second appendix, I cannot wait to talk about.
Excellent. That's your assignment. I'm so happy that we had Eddie Campbell with us this week. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank all of you for listening. If you have any questions, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. You can find us everywhere. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future.